Hey there. Next week, for the first time, we're going to record the WUNC Politics podcast in front of a live studio audience. It's going to be February 21st, that's a Thursday, 9 a.m. at the Friday Center in Chapel Hill. Congressman David Price is the guest. We'll have a conversation, and he will also take some questions from you. Tickets are free. Information about how to RSVP is at our website, WUNC.org. Hopefully, we'll see some of you there. In the meantime, here's this week's podcast.
Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them, and our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the WUNC Legislative Studios, for the final time on the ground floor, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Today we're chatting about independent redistricting, possible changes to the AVC existing framework here in North Carolina, and a little bit more with fifth-term House Representative Chuck McGrady of Henderson County. Hey there, Representative. How are you?
Quite well.
Thanks for being here. I want to start with independent redistricting. You and along with a Republican colleague, John Hardister from Guilford County, as well as with a couple of Democrats, Brian Turner from Buncombe, Robert Reeves from Chatham, there was a proposal introduced, the latest iteration for independent redistricting. I'm going to just give a little bit, and then I want you to take it from there. This would provide what you aim would be a non-political process to draw political maps. It would include an 11-member board, four Republicans, four Democrats, and then three folks who are not part of either of those two parties.
That's right.
This is a proposal that, to be blunt, these types of proposals came forward when the Republicans were in the minority. They didn't go anywhere. They've come forward now with Republicans in the majority, Democrats in the minority, haven't gone anywhere. Why are you optimistic that this could be different?
Well, this is a different year. We've got a lot of new members. But besides that, we're now coming up on a time when the census will be done. And we're at a point in time when neither the Democrats nor the Republicans are sure they're going to be in charge. And so rather than take the chance of the worst thing happening, having the other party be responsible for redistricting, this is the time when they may take the lesser of the evils and go to nonpartisan redistricting. The other thing is litigation. I mean, we've been litigating either on over racial issues or partisan gerrymandering issues really since 2011. And we've got a U.S. Supreme Court case that is going to be heard and decided. We're looking like we're going to have a North Carolina Supreme Court case or cases. And again, I think my colleagues would prefer to resolve the problem as opposed to having the judiciary resolve it for them. There was a Pennsylvania case that's particularly noteworthy in that rather than determining that partisan redistricting is unconstitutional under the federal constitution, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court found it was unconstitutional under the state constitution. You could potentially make that same argument here. And so in the face of all of these things sort of coming together at once, this really has been the best opportunity we've been looking forward to getting to this session.
I want to stick with the litigation for a moment. Thinking about the last 30 years or so, Democrats drew the maps coming out of the 1990 and 2000 censuses. and then there were challenges from the right. In 2010, out of that census, the Republicans drew the maps. And then, as we know, there have been plenty of legal challenges from the Democrats. Why are you confident that putting it out to an independent commission is going to result in less litigation as opposed to litigation from both sides who may be unhappy?
Well, it would certainly take the partisan redistricting piece off if the people putting together the maps include people from all sides. Moreover, the process is, as you know, is not very transparent. In fact, not transparent at all on occasion. And this bill will provide a much more transparent process. And in the face of that transparency, and you look to Iowa, which has a similar process, they've never had to go all the way through. Ultimately, the plans put forward by the nonpartisan commission in Iowa have been approved by the Iowa legislature. And so the precedent that's out there would suggest we'll stop litigating. There are other ways to reach the same end. And so my intention, and you'll see this next week, my intention is to give my colleagues another way of doing it, as opposed to the commission method, which the bill that Representative Reeves and I introduced involve. You could also do it via a constitutional amendment and mm-hmm. let the people vote on it. And in that model, you basically just you constitutionalize the criteria and don't allow maps that take into account where incumbents live or the political party nature of the various districts. Focus on compactness and
sure.
and issues like that.
I think it's worth noting, sure, a lot of our listeners know this, but as a reminder, the governor in North Carolina does not have the ability to weigh in on redistricting issues. He or she cannot veto redistricting matters, with the exception of, I believe, judicial redistricting.
You're right. The governor doesn't have a role in redistricting, the big ones being obviously the congressional and the General Assembly, although we have also on occasion weighed into the local redistricting. Just like with local bills, the governor doesn't play a role there.
We did ask you yesterday at the press conference what your conversations had been with leadership, Speaker Tim Moore, Senate Leader Phil Berger. You passed on that, understandably. We caught up with the speaker later in the day. I wanted to, I guess, just you might have already seen this, and you've obviously already had conversations with him, but one of the concerns he raised when some reporters were chatting with him on the House floor yesterday was that this is, and we've heard this before, this isn't a new argument, that it's an inherently political process. And he, he posed this rhetorical question. He said, are we thinking that we're going to locate folks on this redistricting commission who are knowledgeable and interested in legislative redistricting but don't have a political agenda? You've heard this criticism before. How do you respond to it? Who would serve on that board, and how is it realistic to think we're going to take politics out of it, or are we just diminishing
the partisan nature? You can take politics out of it completely. I mean, again, as you outline, some of the appointments to the commission are going to be completely made by political players and presumably from the two major parties. But by making it more transparent and including a somewhat broader group of people, you're, again, based on Iowa, it's worked. And so, yeah, I'm not naive enough to think that, you know, all politics will go out of it. But if you actually can't look at where incumbents live or some of the political data that is now so much easier to look at, I think the process is one that the public would like better than the one we're in.
There are several states that do have independent redistricting in some form. Iowa, California, I believe the voters in Colorado just voted to approve it back in November. Under your proposal, just, I guess, give us a brief sense of how it would work. We talked about this 11-member commission. If this were to go through and become law, there are these 11 folks that would establish political maps. And what happens from there? They put forward
the political maps. I mean, this is just a statutory provision. The state constitution gives that responsibility to the legislature. And so unless you're running a constitutional amendment, you can't actually take away the decision making from the legislature. But again, it's almost like, because of the process and the group of people that are working on it in a transparent fashion, you sort of shame the legislature into being less partisan than they might otherwise be if it was being handled behind closed doors by experts that are mapping for both parties. That's just not going to happen.
Speaker Moore did signal that he expects this to get at at the very least, or at the very most, a committee hearing. And as you're signaling, you said it yesterday, you're saying it again today, it's likely we're going to see other proposals from you, and I would expect from some other members of potentially Republican and or Democratic caucuses.
Yeah, I expect to see that, and I didn't respond to the question yesterday, but now that the Speaker has said it, I can confirm he's told me the same thing, that we have to have this discussion. And what I've said to the Speaker and to the Rules Chair and any of our leadership is, let me work on this. I'll put forward a proposal or two or three. There may be other proposals, but let's see, if you don't like the commission way, which the House actually passed in 2011,
right,
then let me give you another way to the same ends. And so I expect to introduce another bill next week that will get to the same place, but in a different way.
And depending on what happens with court cases, if it feels as though at some point in 2019 the walls are closing in, that could speed up the process or speed up the debate on independent redistricting. Is that a fair way to look at it?
I think that's fair.
Chuck McGrady here on the WDNC Politics Podcast. You can follow him on Twitter at Chuck McGrady. You're a busy man here at the legislature. You tend to be perhaps busiest early in the session. Were you ever a weightlifter? I mean, it feels as though the heavy lifts you attempt to do are frequent around here, from redistricting, ABC, boards and commissions, eminent domain.
Repealing House Bill 2.
House
you know,
Bill
there's coal ash management. No, I don't like, I like to work on substantive issues. I view my job as more than just pushing a red or a green button on bills that others put before me. I'm a product, like other members, of their committee assignments to some degree. So this, I never expected 8 years ago that I'd ever become so knowledgeable on ABC issues, for example. My background, though, in working on the environment issue suggests why the coal ash issue arrived on my desk as a sophomore. I work completely through the session. I'm a budget chair on top of all this. So you may, you know, from the outside, it may look like I get quiet substantively for some period of time, but that's only because, you know, the real meat of government is how you we tax, we bring in revenues, and then how do you apply those monies to the priorities of the state? And so that's actually my biggest role.
You are an environmentalist. You, I believe, are the only Republican to ever lead the Sierra Club nationally. As a conservative, is it frustrating? Is it challenging? What is it when you deal with the climate change conversation and members of your party and your caucus?
Well, I don't know if I'm the only Republican ever. It goes back to Teddy Roosevelt days, but certainly the only Republican recently. I guess protecting air and water for future generations to me sounds like a conservative concept. We've just got, you know, the politics and the underlying philosophy is sort of disconnected. I was speaking with former Congressman Bob Inglis from South Carolina this past weekend, another conservative all he's doing now is climate change. And so you can come at environmental issues from a conservative stance. Maybe the way you try to solve them would be different. But, you know, if we can agree on the end, meaning, you know, this clean up water or air or whatever the issue is, you know, we can fight over how you get there.
Any bills or plans that you would preview here for us related to the environment that you plan to introduce here in the next?
I've got one that I fully expect that we're going to continue to work with the Department of Environmental Quality on water quality issues, and that may turn out to be a money issue. Mm-hmm. The Coal Ash Management Act was very aggressive when we passed it in terms of its deadlines and all. And I actually voted against the second one of those bills, even though I wrote it.
Because it was amended and altered
the original bill I supported. The second bill I worked on, but I just couldn't get it where I need to be. So I'm hopeful there'll be some changes there. And the fun one for me is honeybees. And we're doing some of the best research here in the state on that issue. and yet the facility that they're working out of should be condemned. And so it's a huge economic issue, and we really do not know why honeybee hives are not as healthy as they were 20, 30 years ago. And so another issue, Representative Harrison and Warren and I are working on a plastics bill. So, yeah, there's plenty to do there, too.
All right. We're going to transition and chat about alcohol here for a little while. Many of the ABC laws that are still in existence in the state were born out of prohibition. They're going on 80 years old. Stop me at any point if I'm mistaken on this.
No, they're prohibition-era laws that have maybe been, you know, tweaked a little bit at various points in time, but our ABC system really hadn't been overhauled for a while.
On one end of the spectrum, there is the call for the effort to privatize the ABC system. That seems like a heavy lift. Not to say it can't be done, but a heavy lift. And then I think there are some other changes, just to throw out a couple, changing how restaurateurs or business owners can physically get liquor. There would also be perhaps opening liquor stores on Sundays. You've introduced a pretty extensive bill. Give me a relatively condensed summary of what it is you're trying to achieve with ABC
laws. Well, I haven't introduced a bill
yet,
but
okay.
And I tend to move away from, you know, calling this privatization, but I really think it's a modern licensure way of dealing with ABC. The majority of states over 30 are not handling alcoholic beverages in the way that we do, meaning we're still in the sale and distribution of distilled spirits. And philosophically, I don't think we ought to be there. Moreover, we got a monopoly on that, and it's amazing we can even lose money on occasion. How only government could manage to pull that off.
Let me just interject quickly. When you say lose money, we're talking about some specific counties within North Carolina that don't turn a profit despite being the only ones that sell liquor.
That's right. And also, the audit report last year of the ABC boards, the commission's warehousing processes. So there's just a lot of inefficiency there. And I think there's a model you can move to a modern licensure method. Now, the key there, though, is the money. Follow the money. And over the years, we've tied, there are like eight different add-ons, and then we sort of trickle that money back to do good things, schools, public education on alcohol abuse. And so, you know, it is an impossible list if you're just going to change it and not account for those monies. And so those monies are going to have to, I'm working to assure the local governments that they will still get the monies, but get them out of the business of distributing alcohol, selling and distributing alcohol. And it is a heavy lift. Again, I'm quite willing to go incrementally. The Program Evaluation Division put out a report this week, which would be what I would call a transition, consolidating a lot of these boards. It's very inefficient. I expect to also introduce that bill. So again, I'm not one to just say, you know, it's my way or no way. I'm going to move incrementally. And then you've touched on the other piece. Just as we've done with vineyards and wine and craft brewing, mm-hmm. and cider, we need to do the same thing, because now we've suddenly got this craft distilling business, and our laws never even conceive of that.
Right.
And so there's just a myriad of ways that, and arcane rules that are out there that inhibit.
Will you give us an example?
There's how do you pay for it? You have to go to the ABC store to pick up the alcohol. The where stamps go on bottles. I mean, it's just, you just sit there. And my view is alcohol is alcohol is alcohol. And therefore, there ought to be, in a general way, parity between the three. Now, again, I recognize alcohol, distilled spirits are a little bit different, but again, we had just haven't moved. We're still with Prohibition era laws and rules. And so just as I've done in these other areas, I fully expect to have what I'll call a regulatory reform bill that will be mostly about distilled spirits, mm-hmm. but we'll continue to make some changes regarding beer and wine and other things.
One of the things we heard at a report that was presented this week that North Carolina is a control state, and consumption-wise, per capita, North Carolina is either the lowest or the second lowest in the Southeast, and they're still making money. I have a hunch you might contend that argument is flawed, or do you think that is a fair argument from the other side?
Well, I mean, some would say that the fact that we've got the lowest consumption among the states is a good thing. I'm saying that probably the facts aren't completely true, because at least in my county, we're a border state, and some of the consumption is still going on, but it's just going, you go down to South Carolina and pick up your distilled spirits or alcoholic beverage of choice.
Better prices, better selection.
Exactly. And so I'm not sure, you know, that's something to be proud of. Moreover, again, look at what happened with the craft brewing industry. I mean, this is a huge economic driver, and it's not what my grandparents would have thought a brewery is like.
Right.
This is a place where family goes, the dog comes, there's games for the kids, and so what? Adults have adult beverages in a setting where there may be music and food, and we really just haven't kept abreast of things. We don't even provide for bars in the state. We know they're there, but we don't. The law doesn't actually recognize them.
Chuck McGrady is a Republican from Henderson County, and that Henderson-Buncombe region has just a bunch of craft breweries. I've asked, you're not going to like this question, but I've asked people who have come on before, what is their favorite local beer or local craft brewery? Do you have one?
Well, I mean, the first one that I actually, that got me into all this is Southern App, which is in Hendersonville.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, the next one was not, no longer considered a craft brewery, but it's Sierra Nevada. And, you know, they're probably the biggest restaurant in Western North Carolina.
The Disney World of beers, if you, and I mean that in a decent way, but
you know, you can sit out there and look at the mountains and the river, and it's a really enjoyable place. The closest one to me actually is a cidery, though.
Okay.
So I've got cideries. Henderson County is the largest apple producer, and so it's a natural fit to have your cideries right near where the apples are being harvested.
Trying to be aware of your time, we're going to tick around a little bit here. So consider the next few minutes a bit of a random stretch. You are quick to mention, frequent to mention, that you used to run a summer camp.
I did.
And I'm wondering, what was either your favorite time of day or week during the summer camp, or what was your favorite activity about camp?
Favorite activity's hard. I was a counselor at the camp, and I went to camp. When I was a kid, it was all about horses. When I was a counselor, it was all about rock climbing and backpacking and whatnot. And when I was a director, the horses are 24 hours, 7 days a week, 52 weeks of the year, and they were my least favorite activity.
Because you had to feed them and care for them and deal with
all
of
that. Yeah. Camp is just so much fun, because every day is different. You get up, you know, one day it's raining and one day it's not, and one day you've got half your kids out of camp. I always loved the late afternoon early evening when kids were either in their own age groups or getting ready to go to bed. I love the kids getting to camp, and then the Sunday after they all go home. You have all the nice memories, but you have none of the responsibilities.
is camp still incorporated in your life to any extent now?
Well, the summer camp I ran just celebrated its 50th anniversary, but no, my legislative schedule is utterly inconsistent. With that said, I mean, legislation comes up. A few years ago, health and safety regulations, you know, tried to shut down a primitive camp because it didn't do things well. The camp was supposed to be about how we lived in the 1850s, and so we changed the law to do that. So I've amazingly gotten to do camp several different times here, and I expect to have actually a high elements and zipline course bill.
Interesting.
This session. Representative Davis has been working on this issue. I've got an approach to it, and I've been talking to him. I do some things to keep me happy.
Quick follow-up. Which present state lawmaker would you most like to harness up and put in a zip line and send on their way?
Oh, good Lord. Now, I better take the fifth on that. I do quip often that it would have been good training to be a legislator if everybody had to go to summer camp, because you learn how to play well with others. And we don't always play well with others here.
Would a one-week summer camp for 170 legislators be a good, a great, or a terrible idea?
It'd be terrible for the camp director. All those adults, oh, good Lord, children are so much easier to deal with than adults. I don't think you'd get it in 1 week. I really think you need to, make it a criteria for running for the legislature. If you've got it in your past and you've learned these ways to work with people when you're a child, you're likely to continue to do that when you're an adult. Trying to make an intervention in adulthood, I don't know that would get us anywhere.
And inevitably, if you had an adult camp with state legislators, you'd have to have some ABC regulations for the camp.
The camp would divide into two teams, the D's and the R's and the reds and the blues, I suspect. You're right. I never thought about this.
Going to take a sharp turn and ask you about Congressman John Lewis. A little birdie told me that you go way back with Congressman Lewis. You were friends from, or your acquaintances from your days in Atlanta. He was an elected official. You were a young lawmaker. I had no idea until somebody just casually mentioned this to me this week. Tell me about your relationship
John
with John Lewis.
And his wife and I, we work together. I served with her on an environmental board down there. He was a city councilman. And when I first started doing environmental work, I was a lawyer, and the Sierra Club was going to do some clean air conference, and I pointed out to them that they would need a permit to do it, and they asked me to get that. The next thing, before I knew it, I'd become their clean air guy. And when John first ran for Congress, I worked with him. He won in against Julian Bond, who was expected to win that thing. And when he first went to Congress to orientation, I was at his side. He was at my wedding, and
you were at his wedding.
We don't. No, I wasn't.
You were not. Okay.
He was married before I met him, I haven't seen him a lot now that I'm no longer in Georgia, but we've run into each other two or three different times, and you talk about a guy that just lives his values. He's that type of guy, and we're probably different on some set of issues, but on environmental issues, he and I worked quite well together. He was always willing to take the lead.
Middle ground, go figure. Imagine that.
Yep.
As you can only imagine, when reporters have downtime, and we've had a little downtime in the last couple weeks. We start to think about, who's going to do what next, or who's going to step aside. And I'm going to just throw this curveball at you, because as we've had this shakeup on the state Supreme Court, we've had the Chief Justice retire. We've had Sherry Beasley move over. We've got Justice Paul Newby, who's up in 2020. There are going to be three state Supreme Court seats on the ballot in 2020. And at one point in my infinite boredom, that's too strong. But in some of the downtime I've had in recent weeks, I thought, I wonder if Representative McGrady would ever be interested in running for the state Supreme Court. So you can pass on it, but we're throwing you on the spot here. And what level of interest does that do you have in that?
None.
Why not?
My interest is, and I've spent a lifetime working to save and protect a lot of really neat places. And I now need to go back and spend some time in those neat places. I'm already started that. I'm sort of doing a hike a week at DuPont State Recreational Forest.
Very nice.
And so I'm going to check off every one of those trails in my backyard. I've not done much in the Smoky Mountains, having been more in the Pisgahs and the Blacks, and so probably head over there a little bit. And then very much want to get out west. That John Denver line about coming home to a place you've never been before never meant a lot when I first heard it. But then I started doing some hiking and camping in the deserts and the canyonlands of the Southwest, and I now know what that means.
I think it would be unfair for me to not ask, is this your last term at the legislature?
You could ask. I have not made any announcement on that. It's well known that I get a little bit cranky.
Good word.
At times and frustrated. But I do believe in term limits for people, and I've now served four terms. The reason to come back this time was redistricting. I saw the opportunity on ABC. I think we need to do something on coal ash. I'm the only one that has spent a lot of time disaster relief. We've got another big piece there, and almost all that work was that I was involved in. So there was a good, really good reason for me to come back another term. After this session, I can probably get a sense as to whether there are some things that I'm uniquely qualified to do, and I'll make the decision.
On Twitter, at Chuck McGrady, now in his fifth term, a representative from Hendersonville, western part of the state. Representative, thank you for coming on the podcast and spending some time with us.
Been fun to have a conversation.
Always glad to have you here as well. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher. Find out what is happening throughout the week in North Carolina political news at our website, wunc.org. For Chuck McGrady, I'm Jeff Tiberi. Enjoy your weekend.